And I'm glad that Rabbi Gottlieb follows me so he can correct all of the mistakes that I might make in the first hour. But okay. Again, the course or the subject matter or the different movements, just want to give a little historical background. The 19th century, the 1800s, is an extremely important period in modern Jewish history, from a religious and a secular perspective. There's actually a remez in the Zohar that the middle of the 19th century would be a very, very significant tekufa. The Zohar HaKadosh says on the Pasuk by Nayach that it was in the 600th year of Nayach, Nifka'u Mayanas Tahaim, the inner springs of the depths of the earth were opened, V'arubais HaShamayim Niftechu, and the windows of the heavens were opened. So the Zohar says, remember the Zohar, we just had the Hilul of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, although I saw that Rav Hillel says that the original Makairis actually said Rav Shimon Bar Yochai didn't die in Lag B'Omer, but okay. But the Zohar HaKadosh says that in the 600th year of the Mea Hashishis, of the 6th millennium, that's 5600, in other words, the 600th year of the 6th Aleph, the Aleph Hashishi, there will be great, great kochos of chachma that will be niskala in the world. Mayim is a remez to chachma. And if you look, so let's say that's the 5600s, that's the middle of the 19th century. So the middle of the 19th century was the Industrial Revolution, tremendous advances in technology. It was basically the Tekufa around the Vilna Gaon and after the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, the Nesivos, the Ketzais. You have Chochmas HaTorah. It was a great period of music and art. It was a great period of literature. And it was a great period of many political movements. And again, all the Mefarshim explain that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put certain kaychas into the world. And those kaychas could be used for Kedusha. And those same kochos could be perverted and used for Tumah as well. That even Tumah, if Tumah has a certain kiyum in the world, it comes from a ruchniyistika power that came into the world that was misused or distorted. So it's no accident that in the middle of the 19th century, besides the Industrial Revolution on one hand, and besides the Chachma of Torah on the other hand, we have the beginnings of Zionism. We have the beginnings of Haskalah. We have the growth, not mamish the beginning, but the growth of the reform movements. In other words, you're going to find tremendous good things happening and tremendous bad things happening. But it comes from a certain kayach of innovation, of creation, of hischadshus that HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts into the Bria. Even Zionism itself, you know, the Bris Karav, who was not a Zionist by any definition at all, you know what they always say, the Briskers who live in Eretz Yisrael are anti-Zionist, and the Briskers who live in Chutz Laaretz are pro-Zionist, an interesting mapecha. But the Bris Karav said that the United Nations recognition of a Jewish state in 1948 was a smile from Shemayim in the aftermath of the Holocaust, that after such a massive Chorban, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a place that we could go to. But he says there was a kilkel, but the Tzionim were makalkel. In other words, there is a pervasive theme in a lot of things that HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts tremendous kochos that can be used in a good way, but because of we have bechira, we can sometimes take a precious matana and be makalkel it. But that doesn't mean it wasn't a matana. It means that maybe it wasn't always used in the right way. This is what the Bris Karav himself said. And the Ger Rebbe is said to have remarked. He said it on three things. I don't remember three. I remember only two of the three. He said, it's a chaval that Zionism was taken over by the Zionists, because it should have been taken over on some level by the Bnei Torah. And it's a chaval that Tshuva was taken over by the Baalei Tshuva. I may have mentioned this before. Meaning to say that people identify Tshuva as only things that a segment of Klal Yisrael does. Those who came from non-religious homes, when in fact the kayach of tshuva is something that every single yid should be mirror himself to tshuva, to ischadshus, to kirvas alokim, and the like. Once again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu put kayachas in the 6-day war. most people say, you know, the beginning of what's called the Kira movements, in Or Sameach, Eishet Torah, all of these things, these are essentially products of the six-day war. In Israeli society in particular, and in America too, the six-day war seemed to be such an amazing thing, to get the Yushalayim back and to get the Kaisel, Maravi, and it was so fast, you know, 6 days, that there was a tremendous hisairus. Volba wrote Kudresim about it. A tremendous hisairus for tshuva in the aftermath of the six-day war, and all of the whole Baal Tshuva movement comes from there. But as I say, perhaps there was a kilkel, you know, we had the Yom Kippur War afterwards and the like, that people, we did not always rise to the challenge to the same degree that we could have risen. And that's the whole story of Shir HaShirim. Kail Daidi Daifek. The voice of my beloved, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is knocking at the door, calling us to do tshuva, calling us for geula. But what does the woman say? Who's Klal Yisrael? The woman says, I've already gone to sleep, right? Just read the psukim. I've gone to sleep for the night, etc. How can I get dressed again? And then she finally decides to get up, and by that time, the man is not there anymore. That's the story. That's the tragic story of Klal Yisrael, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts into the world zamanim in which he yearns for us, and he's ready to give us geula, but we don't rise to the occasion. And by the time we get our act together, it's not the zman anymore. Right? That's kol daidi daifek. This mam is the pashat pshat of the psukim in Shir HaShirim. So the 19th century is a very important part. Just to mention the movements, Latov or Lara, wherever you characterize it. We have, number one, the establishment of the yeshiva movements. Something that's undoubtedly very dear to your hearts, the idea of yeshivas and kailolim. Now, we'll have to explain that, because for Shteitzach, there are always yeshivas in Klal Yisrael. But yeshivas used to be localized, in the time of the Amora, in the time of the Amora and the Ga'inim, you did have worldwide yeshivas. But for most of European history, yeshivas were localized Bate Medrash. But the modern yeshiva, a centralized place where people came from many countries, that was Volozhin, was the yeshiva movement in the middle of the 1800s. And Volozhin was called the Eim HaYeshivas. In fact, there's a two-volume sefer in Hebrew called Eim HaYeshivas, which is about... I'm sorry, the other one. It's called Av HaYeshivas. It's the biography of Chaim Volozhin. But Volozhin is called the Eim HaYeshivas. And Volozhin has an amazingly interesting history. I'm not sure if I should share it with you or not, because apparently Bachram and Volozhin were very independent. If they didn't like what the Rosh Yeshivas did, they would riot or they would go on strike. Or I just read a Maisa. I'm going ahead of myself, but I just read it today, so interesting Maisa, where the Netziv saw Bachram who cut his payas, and the Netziv gave him a slap in the face. I don't know how hard it was. And the whole yeshiva refused, it was Shavuos or something, and the whole yeshiva refused to go over to give the Netziv good yomtiv. They just refused. And the Netziv was calling out, you know, good yomtiv, Kindlech, good yomtiv, and nobody answered. The whole yeshiva didn't answer. And finally, he got up. He had to get up, and he says, I'm asking mechila from you. I did something wrong. Please forgive me. Then everybody shouted, you know, good yomtiv, Rebbe. You know, it was they're very... very tough, independent people. Many of them were Iluyim. Iluyim are sometimes temperamental, but they made. But be it as it may, Volozhin is called the mother of yeshivas. And from Volozhin, you had later Mir and Slobodka and Tels and Panovich, and all of these great yeshivas that still, Bizman Hazeh, these are yeshivas. Now these are the Litvashi yeshivas in Hungary and in Galicia, which is southern Poland. There were also yeshivas, great yeshivas, but they had somewhat of a different derech and the like. And we'll talk about that, but that's one thing that there was. On the other side of the coin, you had Haskala. Now, Haskala is one of those very misleading names, because Haskala means enlightenment. And it is a word that appears in Tanakh, always in a positive way. Maskil le David. Maskil comes from Seichel, a capital of wisdom and enlightenment. Or it talks about Maskil el Dal, the person who has the Seichel to take care of the poor. So the word Maskil in Tanakh is always used in a Shevach way for a person who's a Baal Torah and Yireh Shemayim. However, the Haskalah was a self, I mean, they gave themselves the name, was a movement in 19th century Europe, which was designed to bring the Jewish population in tune with modern society. And the concept was, let's break the ghetto doors down, let's introduce Jews to Chochmas Chitzonios, get them into universities, get them into colleges, get them to be integrated in society. Now here, and again, each of these things we're going to talk about Biarichas, I just want to introduce vocabulary, and again, I apologize if this is familiar to you all. The founder of this movement called Haskalah is actually a very interesting fellow, Moshe Mendelssohn, Moses Mendelssohn. And Moses Mendelssohn himself, this is already the beginning of the 1800s. Moses Mendelssohn was a shomer mitzvahs all of his life. He was an Orthodox person. He was, you know, he ate kosher and was not mechallel Shabbos. But he was like the first Jew, really the first Jew who in Germany was able to get like a secular education somehow. And he became a very well-known philosopher who was very well respected. But again, you have to know what it was. The anti-Semitism was so strong that a Jew who knew philosophy was regarded in the same way that a dog who knew how to talk. In other words, the Goyim were like amazed. Gee, you have this Jew that knows philosophy. You know, in other words, he was accepted, but he was almost accepted as kind of a freak. It wasn't like respect for the Jewish people. It was like, wow, it's amazing that even a Jew is able to converse with deep philosophy. I mean, you see how perverse it was. I mean, Yidden had the deepest understanding, but the guy considered Jews to be backward and primitive and ignorant. And Mendelssohn was someone who was very well educated, and people were very impressed. They would say things like, oh, you can't really be Jewish. I mean, maybe you're half Jewish, maybe you have some German blood. This can't be a Jewish person talking here. But anyway, Mendelssohn spawned Talmidim. And, you know, the Talmidim were people who tried to integrate culture. Now, you have to understand, Maskilim came in many, many colors. Many, many colors. There were Maskilim who were from, who believed in Torah Umada, Torah Derech Eretz, things that came later. There were Maskilim who wanted to be Oiker, Tyra Lagamri. There were Maskilim that were Kaifrim. There were Maskilim who were not so bad necessarily, although their ideas were dangerous. Mendelssohn himself translated the Torah into German. This is called the Bior. And we have some evidence that the Chassam Sofer himself used the Bior of Mendelssohn. On the other hand, we have Chuvas from the Nidei Yehuda, that's, you know, called the Schira Fegiduf, etc. Right? So Haskalah itself is a complicated movement. And I'll give you an example. Haskalah was very widespread. And in particular, I mean, I'll give you an example. The Ketzais. The Ketzais, of course, it was not a mosque. The Ketzais was, you know, the Ketzais was the Ketzais. But the Ketzais' son-in-law, who was actually the editor of many of his Sforim, was a well-known Moscow. He was from, but he was a well-known Moscow, right? So even in these great families, you had Haskalah. Right, so you have the Yeshiva movement, you have the Haskalah, and one thing to keep in mind, again, since we're bringing in a lot of different things, I apologize if things are disorganized, but one thing to keep in mind is the Yeshiva world and the Haskalah world were not two separate worlds. It's not like, oh, the Maskilim are there and the Yeshiva is here. It is emes that one of Rav Chaim Volozhiner's motivations for starting a yeshiva was to create a chizuk of Torah learning that would combat Haskalah. That's very, very true. But Haskalah was often something that found its way within the yeshiva world itself. If you look, for example, this was in Volozhin for sure, and later in Slobodka, there were many people who were maskilim, and the Rosh Yeshiva would occasionally have purges in which they would try to uproot this influence from the yeshiva. Sometimes they were successful, sometimes they were not successful. Haskalah was a major, major problem. And I don't just mean the problem of people, you know, reading some secular studies occasionally, but from the whole hashgafa of Haskalah that was Iker. So, and again, you have to keep in mind, because who went to yeshivas? Yeshivas in Europe, and this goes back to Volozhin, were much more elitist than yeshivas today. Today, though, again, with apologies to the group here, which obviously are very selective, but everyone gets into yeshiva today. If you want to go to yeshiva, in other words, and in fact, for carrots, the hashkafa of every frum person is, I want my child to go to yeshiva. That's what you do. In Europe, it wasn't that way. In Europe, you went to cheder, but when you were 12 or 13 or 14, the average person went out and worked. And Baruch Hashem, you remained from, but by and large, you remained from. You would go to an Ein Yaakov shir, or Mishnayah shir, or Halacha shir. But the concept was not that everybody went to yeshiva. Yeshivas, lahavdil, were like the Harvards, the Yales, the MITs. Yeshivas were for the brightest, the smartest, the iluyim. So that's why the average guy in a yeshiva then was much, much bigger than the average guy in Asia. And again, I'm not positing the golden age. And I'm not saying everybody in Europe was a guy. I'm saying for carrots. There were average Jews in Europe too, but the average Jew in Europe was not in a yeshiva. Now, in a yeshiva, you had mitzuyonim. Yeshivas were geared primarily to mitzuyonim. So you have to understand that it's precisely the mitzuyonim that had the strongest netiyah sometimes to Haskalah, because they wanted to broaden their knowledge, they wanted to know languages, they wanted to know other chachmas, they wanted to go beyond. In fact, they even say Rav Chaim's derech, Rav Chaim's own chiddush of a derech halimut, was a way to combat Haskalah, because Rav Chaim wanted to show that learning of Torah is not just memorizing a lot of knowledge, but there's an analysis, a mahalach, an intellectual approach. In fact, it's interesting that some Gedalim were against Rav Chaim's approach because they thought it was too secular. It's hard to fully explain this, but they thought that by intellectualizing Limud HaTorah, you were trying to make it like a university course. So you actually see some Gedalim saying Rav Chaim was secularizing Limud HaTorah. But the emes is, which was Rav Chaim's derech, that was able to convey to a lot of guys that there is such an intellectual depth. Torah is not just about memorizing facts, but there are patterns and generalizations and yesodos and the like. So here's the point I'm making. We have the world of the yeshiva and we have the world of Haskalah. But these were not two different worlds. Rather, the world of Haskalah was sometimes deeply embedded in the world of the yeshiva. And one of the great milchamas that the yeshivas were waging was to try to combat the influence of the Haskalah. In fact, Rav Chaim Shalevitch used to say with Mir that when occasionally there were problems in Mir here, he would say that he said he was wrong. He thought after the war, after World War II, the problems of the Haskalah went away. He says he sees, unfortunately, they haven't gone away. Now, the emes is, I would say that Bizman Hazeh, the problem is not so much Haskalah. Haskalah was the Yetzirah of intellectualism, philosophy. I mean, for example, if you would ask somebody in the 19th century if a Jew should go to university, most Gedolim would tell you no. But why would they tell you don't go to university? So they would tend to say, because you'll be exposed to philosophical ideas that are connected to Torah. You'll read Spinoza, who was a bona fide Epicurus. Spinoza was a real Epicurus, a Jewish guy, all these guys. Now, today, if you ask somebody what's wrong with the college campus, it's not going to be, you're going to read Spinoza and you'll become an Epicurus. Now, halvai people would read Spinoza, in the sense. Meaning, today, society is so debased that the challenges of a Tamei Seviva are not intellectual. Because who in college is involved in intellectual activity? I don't mean to make a generalization, but nobody is. But by and large, that's not the Nisayan. You're not going to walk into a college campus and people are reading Plato and Aristotle and Spinoza and, debating about the various proofs for the existence of God. That's not what's going on. What's going on is Nus. What's going on is Taiva. So it's a totally different world. The world of the 19th century, in many ways, was a more refined world. The Yetzer Hara was one of Seichel. one of philosophy, one of ideas. The Maskilim were intellectuals. Moses Mendelssohn was certainly a great intellectual. And therefore, the yeshiva world was created to create a saviva of high-class mitsuyanim intellectuals who would see in the Chachma Satira that the Chachma of the world doesn't really have that same shavius. Today, it's a different situation. Today, and that's why paradoxically, you'll find that in the yeshivas, like before the Muslim movement, I'll get to that, in Volozhin, Volozhin wasn't big on mashgichim. Volozhin wasn't big on rules. Volozhin wasn't big on telling you don't go to movies. I mean, there weren't movies then. Because Volozhin's challenge was the challenge of intellectualism, and they combated that challenge with the intellectualism of Torah. So they weren't talking about going to Ben Yehuda or going to, you know, that wasn't the issue. An average Volozhin guy wasn't fooling around in those ways. Today, yeshivas are much more involved, at least for younger guys. Again, you know, can't go here, and all sorts of rules and regulations. And because today, the Nisayan is much more taiva than it is intellectual. And that's why the yeshivas have become... Taiva, meaning today, the issue is not that people are challenged. Now again, Or Samech might be a little better because people who are Chozrei B'Tshuva are interested philosophically, but by and large, the world as a whole is not a very intellectually oriented world. The world as a whole is meshuka, is enmeshed in physical desires for pleasure. Desires for money, desires for ease of life, you know. And as a result, that's why yeshivas maybe become less intellectual, which might be a chisaron, but they become more I don't want to say prison, but, you know, more rules. You know, can't go here, you go here, you know, they kick you out, you know. Volozhin was not, no, in Volozhin the concept was you were a grown-up, you were an adult. We're not going to watch where you go, but we don't want there to be these influences of Haskalah in the yeshiva that are going to be negative. But so we have the yeshiva movements, we have the Haskalah movement. Now, both of them are occurring within the Torah world, because even the Maskilim, who eventually rejected the Torah, they came out of the Torah world. So in other words, it came from the Torah world, per se. Now, then you have other things, which are mamish chutz l'machaneh l'gamri, and that is the Reform movement. But even the Reform movements. Now, the Reform movement started, as you know, in Germany. But, you know, the Reform movement started off relatively harmless. And it was only Gedalim that saw that it was the beginning of a poisonous root. Right? It began with giving drushos in German instead of Yiddish. I mean, this is something... I mean, every rabbi in America, well, not every rabbi, but every non-Hasidic shul in America, we give drushas in English, right? Although I remember, I was once, I used to give a shir in Baltimore many years ago, and I was giving a shir in Sefer HaMitzvahs. It was in a Hasidic shtibel. And a guy calls me over and says, you know, there's a sign on the wall here that there's a cherem of the Chassam Sefer that in a Beis HaKnesses you're only allowed to give a shir in Yiddish. So he told me that if I want to give a shir in English, I have to do it in the side room. You can't do it in the Beis Medrash itself. But little things. Even today, I don't know if any of you have been to Poland, but if you go to Krakow, and Krakow still has many of... I was in Krakow just around 6 weeks ago. If you're in Krakow, Krakow still has all the beautiful shuls from before the war. There's an interesting reason why that's so. Krakow was the Nazi capital of occupied Poland, not Warsaw. And Hans Frank, who was a Nazi, he was obviously a Sone Yisrael who murdered many, many Jews, but Hans Frank was a lover of architecture. So he was geyser that in Krakow no building should be destroyed. So he didn't care about people being killed, but no building should. So in Krakow, unlike Warsaw, which is 95% destroyed and rebuilt, in Krakow you still have the Ramaz Shul and the Beis HaKvaris, you have all the things in Krakow. So in Krakow, there's a magnificent shul in Krakow that's called the Reform Temple. Aye, what is a Reform Temple? That's where they gave the drusha in Polish. totally from Shul, but to give the Russian Polish, that's called the Reform Temple. That's how it's Reform in Krakow. So the Reform movement started off relatively innocuously, but eventually, as you know, it became what it became. And it became a great, great source of milchama against Torah.
What date did the Reform movement start?
The Reform movement started around 1810, actually earlier. The Reform movement started relatively early.
Same as Haskalah. The same period.
Yeah, Haskalah and Reform started around the same time. But they are different movements. The Haskalah is not the same as the Reform. Remember, the Haskalah is a movement to essentially expose Jews to secular culture and education. Now, in the Haskalah, there were Reform people, Orthodox people, even B'nai Torah, and Apikorsen. So there is a little bit of overlap between Reform and Haskalah, but they are two very different movements. The Reform was designed to openly change Yiddishkeit. The Haskalah was designed to integrate secular culture into Jewish society. Yeah?
The Rav posit that the reason why Spinoza, who basically did the same thing but 150-200 years earlier, the reason he did not spawn Haskalah is because of the initial point the Rav made, there was no koach for it at the time?
Yeah, there was no koach for it at the time. I'll explain why Haskalah didn't flourish till way after Spinoza. Spinoza was not a movement builder anyway. Spinoza was kind of an isolated guy, although he was a bona fide apikoros. I mean, the truth of the matter is, you know, they tell the story about an apikoros, that a guy wanted to become an apikoros, so he was told in Minsk, he was told he has to meet with Yussel, who's the official apikoros of Minsk. So he's looking in the libraries, in the universities, in the bars. He's looking for an apikoros. Yussel is not to be found. So finally, he's directed to a beis medrash. So he doesn't know why Yussel would be in a beis medrash, but he goes to the beis medrash, and he sees a guy with a long beard learning Gemara. He doesn't look like an apikoros, but he goes to Yussel and he says, I hear you're the apikoros in town, and you kind of admit new members. I want to be an apikoros. So Yussel says, okay, have you finished Shas? He says, no, I don't believe in this stuff. Why should I finish Shas? Do you know Chumash and Rashi? He says, no. So he says, you're not an apikoros, you're only an amoritz. Meaning, to be an emes apikoros, you have to be a shtickle talmid chacham already. So the emes is, Spinoza, so most people who are apikorsim are not really apikorsim, they're amoratzim. Spinoza is Taka an apikoros. Spinoza was someone that knew Torah. He understood things. And as you know, Spinoza was put in a very awesome cherem in Amsterdam. Spinoza lived in Amsterdam. And there was a big, big scene in which 400 people dressed up in black. Very scary. They had a whole ceremony for cherem. We don't really do it that way today. We just put up a wall sign. Someone's in cherem. But in those days, they really did it right. 400 people dressed in black with talesim, and they blow shofars, and they put out the candles, and they declare that he was in cherem until he does tshuva. And Spinoza was the first philosopher who actually took the position that the Torah is not min hashamayim, and it was written by Moshe, and he had logical proofs for it, etc. So it's emes apikorsis. And he's a tremendous, if you've studied philosophy, I'm not saying you should, he's a tremendously influential philosopher in later generations. I mean, all of the philosophy against religion essentially comes from Spinoza. Because medieval philosophy, even Christian philosophy, medieval philosophy, whether it's Christian, Jewish, or Islamic, was in support of the notion of Hashem revealing himself to people. Spinoza was the first philosopher that denied the concept of revelation and denied the concept of Hashem speaking to B'nai Adam. Whether he believed in God as an abstract entity is a shaila in Spinoza, but he certainly did not believe in Torah min Hashamayim or any type of Hashgacha Pratis. Yeah. Well, the yeshivas were not originally for everyone because the challenge of the Haskalah itself, the challenge of Haskalah, was a challenge to intellectual people. So the average working person was not necessarily affected by Haskalah, and therefore he didn't have the makkah, and if he didn't have the makkah, he didn't have the refuah. If you came from a small shtetl, and everybody around you were frum, and everybody around you were shomer mitzvahs, you just fell into the pattern of the society you were in. You were not exposed to these ideas from the larger world. So the yeshivas were designed in part, I'm not saying that's the only reason, but it is brought down in many makoros, that the concept of the yeshiva was a hashkacha min hashamayim to combat the challenges of haskalah.
Wasn't so smart, wanted to learn Torah, didn't allow
me. No, I don't want to put it that way. I don't want to put it that way. Maybe that's too strong of a statement. If a person was really chashka b'tayra, they would make room for him. All I'm saying is the institutions were not geared for that initially. They were geared for special mitsuyanim, and there were many mitsuyanim, etc. And if you were not so gifted, but it was mamash chashka b'tayra, you would have a hard time. In other words, you wouldn't necessarily have a shir that was created for you. But if you worked, once again, now later things changed a little bit. Things did change a little bit. But I'm talking about the initial idea. An average guy didn't get into Volozhin. Volozhin was only for mitzvah. Now, keep in mind too, though, that there were always local Bate Medrash in every city where people learned with chavrusas and this and that. So there always was that makam. You just didn't have the national or international yeshiva for average people.
When the reform started, and they started just small things like giving the drushas in Polish or German or whatever, when they were ultimately they're saying that I'm not interested in where the Dostal Kreuzman is, I'm not interested in the Bedoyla. So it's a bit funny that only with that small thing that they'll do, they'll think that straight away they'll be doing many other things as well.
Well, that is what happened. I mean, that's why the Gedolim at the time. Now, the Gedolim at the time, and again, I'm giving you an overview tonight, so I'm going to fill in details later about names and dates. But the Gedolim at the time, in other words, who are the Gedolim who were the main open opponents of the Reform movement? The Chassam Sofer is probably the most outstanding. The Chassam Sofer was a big, big fighter against the early Reform movement. Rabbi Akiva Eiger, who was the Chassam Sofer's father-in-law, but Rabbi Akiva was also involved, less so. The Chassam Sofer was more of a fighter. The Knight of Yehuda in Prague, right? These were the great, great fighters in the early years of the Reform movement. The Gra was, interestingly enough, not so involved in the Reform movement for a very good reason. I mean, the reason was because the Reform movement had not reached Lithuania and Russia. The Reform movement was Hungary and Germany, and the Chassam Sofer was in Hungary. Germany almost had nobody. Germany was a midbar. You have to understand, I'm going to go a little bit ahead. So the Gra did combat Haskalah. But the Gra was not involved in Reform because Reform was it had no achiza in Poland, at least at that time, and it had no achiza in Lithuania. So it was not something the Gra was directly involved in. I mean, nobody had any havaminas there. But Haskalah was a big Indian. Now, I want to point out the Reform movement in Germany. Now, the Chassam Sofer managed to contain it in Hungary. That was his greatest sphere of influence. But the Reform movement in Germany was so widespread that by the end of the 19th century, let's say by the 1860s, 1870s, all the great kahilas of Germany, Frankfurt, Hamburg, Berlin, were literally taken over by Reform movements. And there were almost didn't have a minion of Shomer Shabbos in many big kahilas. And Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, who was a Rav in Germany, and he was invited by Frankfurt, which had been the biggest Jewish community in Germany. He had been invited to take over to be the Rav of Frankfurt. He was invited by only 10 people, only 10 religious Jews. And he took that job, and over 40 years he revived, he made hundreds and hundreds of people. But so he did a tremendous amount of work in Germany, and he was called Mamish Mechaye Mason. But even then, Germany was overwhelmingly Reform, and from Reform turned into something else. This is already before the Holocaust, and that is mass conversions to Christianity. because in Germany, because here's the point, at some point, if your Yiddishkeit is so watered down, you don't believe in God, you don't believe in Torah, you don't believe in mitzvahs, if the German society then says, hey, you can only get a job if you convert to Christianity, what holds you to be a Jew? Now, Germany happened to have rules that if you wanted a university position, you had to officially be a member of the Lutheran Church, which is the German Protestantism. Now, they didn't care if you believed. You didn't have to believe in anything. You just had to sign a card that you're a member of the church. Hundreds and hundreds of Jews just converted to Christianity. So you see what Reform led to. I mean, from Reform, you led Mamish to be Goyim. Mamish to be Goyim. And that's, well, I don't want to get into that, but the Meshech Chachma wrote in the 19, before World War I even, he wrote that Berlin will be the source of Chorban. He wrote this 30 years before the Holocaust, because those who think Berlin is the new Yerushalayim will see from Berlin the awesome Chorban that will come. So the Reform movement in Germany was absolutely devastating. In Hungary, it did exist, but it was contained because of the Milchama of the Chasam Sofer. In Poland and Lithuania, the Reform movement never really took hold. As I say, the Reform temple in Krakow was, they gave it Russia and Polish, but I mean, it was not a problem. So the challenge in those countries was Haskalah, not Reform, but Reform was a big deal. By the way, the conservative movement, by the way, is actually an American invention. There was no conservative Judaism in Europe per se. There was Orthodox. They didn't call it Orthodox, but it was Orthodox, and there was Reform. This intermediate idea was an American pshara, so to speak. The conservative movement was created in America between the wars, between World War I and World War II. It was a way where people could still have the traditions of the Alter Heim, but without all the restrictions. It was kind of an American pshara. That's why, ideologically, conservative is the most confused of the movements. Now, Reform is pretty clear. We don't believe in Torah and Shemaya. I mean, they're clear. We don't believe in a personal God. We don't believe in mitzvahs. All right, Beseder, that's what they believe. The conservative movement is much more mishubash. It's much more confusing, because they actually say, well, we do believe God gave the Torah, but maybe not all of it. Or God gave the mitzvahs, but maybe not exactly this way. You know, it's much more confused, which might represent the ideological confusion of Americans, who kind of just, we just want a Judaism that's traditional, but that doesn't make too many demands on us. But that's kind of an American, more of an American invention. I'm sorry, someone wanted to say something? I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. So again, today is really just a summary, so I'm throwing out a lot of things. I just want to say one more. I just want to say one more thing about the Reform movement. Rav Yisrael Salanter, who lived towards the end of the 19th century, okay, he's a little later. Rav Yisrael Salanter, let me just finish the sentence. Rav Yisrael Salanter, of course, came from Vilna, but he spent a lot of his life in Germany and France, which were Reform places, largely. And when he was asked, why was he separating himself from Torah communities? He was really living in places in which there were kamat no b'nei Torah at all. He was doing it for Kiruv, actually. But he said like this. He said that when you have a team of wild horses that are running down a mountain slope, it's impossible to stop them till they hit bottom. So he says, Yiddishkeit in Germany hit bottom. Now we can be makariv them. Unfortunately, he thought, in Russia and Poland, because of the Haskalah, the wild horses were still running down the hill. So he actually felt that it would be shaykh to do more kiruv in Germany and France than in Russia and Poland because of the wild horses analogy. I'm sorry, you want to say?
We're looking to do more descriptive problem. Was it just the problem at that time that, for example, that they were completely removed from everything but like Almaza, and therefore at that time anything else was like an influence of the Goyish culture? In other words, nowadays somebody that would be doing the exact same thing, you would say like he's a well-rounded yeshiva.
Yeah, so let me explain this. Haskalah is actually a very complicated movement. because it really is connected to the French Revolution. Let me explain why that's so. Until the French Revolution, Jews were confined in ghettos. Jews were not allowed to go to college. Jews were not allowed to have secular educations unless they had special rishus. Jews were not allowed to have certain businesses and the like. And Mimela, if you were a smart young man, you would go to yeshiva. Like, what else could you do with your head? Now, Napoleon and the French Revolution afterwards created what's called the destruction of the ghetto. And Jews were given, for the first time in Europe, in France, in Germany, later in Russia and Poland, but much later, they were given opportunities to participate in civil society. Now, as a result, you had people like Mendelssohn, who saw Jews as poor, impoverished, as not connected to secular wisdom, as people who were backward, they thought, in some ways. And they thought, by exposing them to secular culture, they would become more educated, more refined, they would advance themselves economically. And this was the Haskalah agenda. Now, some people tried to say the Vilna Gaon was a supporter of Haskalah because the Vilna Gaon believed in secular wisdom. But the emes is, if all Haskalah pushed was knowing secular wisdom, that wouldn't have been such an avla. The Gra, in fact, said, it's good to know Chachmas Chitzonius. The Gra says, every measure of secular wisdom you don't know, you're missing 10 measures of Torah. You know, the Gra commissioned his Talmidim to translate Euclid's geometry into Hebrew. I've actually seen the Sefer. No, Euclid was a Greek mathematician. He wrote the Elements of Geometry. And the Gra translator, and he didn't do it himself, but he had translated into Hebrew books on algebra, trigonometry, science, and the like. So if all the Haskalah would be pushing, would knowing Chachmas Chitonius, we would call that well-rounded. But the problem is that the Maskilim also wanted to bring in not just what you might call the objective things, like science, mathematics, medicine, but also ideologies, hashkafos, philosophy, literature. That was a dangerous thing, because that exposes you to the realms of ideas that are not necessarily Torah-based. That's one thing. But even more than that, and this is a very sad chapter, the Maskilim were helping the governments, the anti-Semitic governments, force yeshivas to change their curriculums, to kind of get rid of the cheder system, replace it with public education. In other words, the Maskilim were trying to actually have government restructuring of the chinuch that were given to Jewish children. They were not just creating opportunities, they were about forcing Jewish education out of its miskeres. The Volozhiner Yeshiva closed in the 1890s, getting in because of the pressure of Maskilim who were pushing the Russian government to introduce secular studies in the curriculum. So, in answer to your question, I would say that the problem of Haskalah was not simply that people should learn secular subjects, but rather they should be mevatel, the type of chinuch that was given to children, that they would get the government involved. And Ad Kedei Kach, by the way, the Maskilim were great. The people the Maskilim hated even more than Bnei Yeshiva was they hated Hasidim. Maskilim absolutely hated Hasidim because the Maskilim wanted to be modern. They wanted to be 19th century gentlemen. They wanted to dress elegantly, which many Bnei Yeshiva did dress elegantly. Bnei Yeshiva were actually, you know, that's a lovely discussion, but they tried to dress like gentlemen of society. But the Hasidim were wearing these old-fashioned uniforms and they were doing wild customs and this and that. So the Maskilim would actually try to get Hasidus outlawed in various places. And they would be malshin on them and get them arrested and get the shuls closed out and the like. So there was a lot of sinas Yisrael in the Haskalah movement. It's not just the ideology. There was some active sinna. But I think overall, I mean, you are correct that some aspects of Haskalah have been mekubal now, and some is even regarded as positive. But this was part of a much bigger movement. Yeah.
What exactly did they want to teach in the lesson that they closed it up?
They wanted to introduce several hours a day of Russian, of literature, of mathematics, of science. they wanted Gemara to be a subject. So Gemara would be like a two-hour subject, imagine. In other words, we'll give you a Talmud course, but Talmud will be a course. You'll do 2 hours a day of Talmud, then Bible, and then homiletics. In other words, the Russian government said, let's make Falujah a school to train rabbis. And a rabbi shouldn't just know, I mean, actually, you have this problem today with Chovei Torah. A rabbi shouldn't just know Gemara. A rabbi needs to know how public speaking. A rabbi needs to know psychology. So the Russian government says, we're going to make the yeshiva a better training ground for rabbis.
It wasn't just language that they wanted.
It was not just language. It was about the Russian government through the maskilim. Because the maskilim were advising the Russian government what to do. The Russian government wanted to restructure the yeshiva to make it a rabbinical seminary that would be controlled by the Russian government. And as you know, the famous history that the Nitziv and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who were the two Russian yeshiva of Volozhin, they closed the yeshiva rather than agree to that. Now, I want to point out that the Velt has a bit of a mistake here. The Velt always says that they closed Volozhin because can't have secular studies, right? This is the common word, that secular studies are so tamei that it's better to close the yeshiva than to have secular studies. This is the common yeshivisha hesper for the closing of Volozhin. And they'll use this. So when you say, I want to go to college, well, they'll say, oh, Volozhin was closed down, instead of having chachmas chitzonius in the yeshiva. And this is the taina against YU and against Toro and against everything else. Now, the emissaries, there's a little bit of a kasha on this. The Nitziv's nephew was a famous person in his own right. This is the Torah Tamima. Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein is the Nitziv's nephew. And his father was the Orach HaShulchan. And the Nitziv was very close to his nephew. His nephew came to Volozhin as a 14-year-old, and he was actually like the Nitziv's secretary. He used to write letters for the Nitziv and the like. And he wrote a 4-volume autobiography, which is an absolutely fascinating sefer, called Makor Baruch. And in volume 4, the whole volume is about the Nitziv and Volozhin. And that's been translated in English, My Uncle the Nitziv. And maybe you've seen it in English, My Uncle the Nitziv. Years ago, around 15 or 20 years ago, the Lakewood Cheder sent out, you know the way organizations send out books for fundraising? So they sent everybody My Uncle the Nitziv as part of a fundraising for the Lakewood Cheder. Very nice book, interesting book. And then around 3 weeks later, we receive a letter from the Lakewood Cheder saying, please return the book at once, and we will refund your contribution. Gedolim have determined that this book is not accurate and does not represent the Hashkafa Satayim. Well, rest assured, when you get a letter like that, you're going to go back and read the book, even if you didn't look at the book until then. Says, what is going on? What's in this book? Well, it turns out what's in this book is the following. The Torah Tamima was an aid re'iyah to the closing of Volozhin. He was in Volozhin when it closed. And this is what the Torah Tamima was made. He was made that the Nitziv did not have a problem with Chachmas Chitzonius in the yeshiva. The Nitziv was willing to have courses in Russian and courses in language in the yeshiva. And in fact, some course was offered. It was offered, you know, Chutz L'Starim. It was offered, in kind of Hester. But the Nitziv was not against it. What the Nitziv was against was to have the Russian Tsarist government structure the curriculum and relegate Gemara to a course. That he couldn't be saved. That would destroy the whole chashivas of Limud HaTorah. So it wasn't so much the kenach that you're offering secular studies, it was the kenach that you're mevatel the primacy of Gemara as the site of Torah Shebal Peh, and you're also having the government control your curriculum, and the government is filled with not only maskilim but Sonei Yisrael Mamish. So apparently the modern-day Gedolim didn't like that taich of Volozhin because they thought that that would give too much of a hechsher to YU or whatever it is. So they say, oh, Torah Tamima is not a reliable aid, and we discount his aidus, and Mimela, we have to say the book is Sheker V'chazav. What can I tell you? I mean, the Torah Tamima was an aid re'iyah. This is what he said. people use, as far as I know, Torah to Mimra was not taken out of Lakewood. I mean, it's on the bookshelves. I don't know, maybe. I can't say I know that for sure, but I assume it's on the bookshelves. People use the Sefer. So, in all likelihood, Rav Baruch Epstein's uptight was probably correct. He also said another thing that people find controversial. He says, a lot of things about the Netziv are very fascinating. First of all, I already told you the Maisa, how the Netziv apologized to the whole yeshiva when he felt he was Mavaza, a Bachar. But the Netziv, every Shabbos, his Shabbos Seder was, he would learn Sechas Shabbos and Erevin, every Shabbos. The Gemara, not just the Mishnayos. But he also read the newspaper. Every Friday he would get a Yiddish newspaper, and his part of his Einik Shabbos was, after he would finish Shabbos and Erevin, he would read the paper.
On Shabbos,
he would read the paper. He says, so that was the chalik of his Einik Shabbos, he says, to
read
the...
What did you read?
No, it was a front paper. It wasn't, you know, but it was a front paper. But again, even the front, I mean, the front papers were not your Tate Naaman. I mean, you have to understand, the religious papers in Europe did have a strong Haskalah type of... It wasn't a Haredi paper, so to speak. But it was worldly. The Netziv was interested in things that happened in the world. And the like, so that too people didn't like so much. You know, in my uncle the Netziv, in the Makor Baruch. I mean, I read it in Hebrew and in English. I read it in both both places. Yeah.
Why is it better to close the yeshiva than leave it open and at least get some
tire in? No, because this is what he said. He said we're going to close the yeshiva because this way people will go privately and they will find teachers of Torah, they will find rabbis. In other words, when you close a yeshiva, you're not destroying Torah, you're basically saying we're not going to have this center, but we'll disperse, and maybe in smaller avenues you can learn Torah al Torah HaKadosh. That was the Netziv's question. The Netziv's question was, it was just like when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the Kaihanim went on the roof, they threw the keys, remember the Gemara? They threw the keys to Shemayim back to the Abishur, and they said, we cannot take care of this the way you want us to take care of it. It is your Achrayas, Hashem, to take care of the Mikdash. And the Netziv basically said, we can no longer keep this yeshiva, Al Tiras HaKadosh, and rather than contaminate it with improper things, we will leave it to the Abishter to be Mekayim, Torah, and Klal Yisrael. Now you have to understand, for Rav Chaim, this was the beginning of his second career. I mean, it was a tragedy, but Rav Chaim became the Rav of Brisk. He took over his father's shteler. For the Netziv, this was towards the end of the Netziv's life. This killed him. The Netziv died a year and a half later in Varsha. And he never recovered. I mean, even emotionally, he never recovered from, I mean, imagine the destruction of Volozhin, the greatest of the yeshivas of Europe. Now, Baruch Hashem, what had happened was, Volozhin produced offspring, meaning by that time, Mir had already started, they were smaller, but there already were other yeshivas that the Russian government was not, for whatever reason, not so interested in getting. Volozhin was the crown jewel. Volozhin was their Harvard. They wanted to get Volozhin. So the Netziv closed down Volozhin. Yeah.
Which is more destructive, the reform movement or the Haskalah?
That's a very, very excellent question. It's hard to say. It's like pick your poison. I think that the Haskalah was more destructive to the Frum world, because Haskalah's Hashkafas did permeate the Frum world. The Frum people did not become reformed so much. But on the other hand, if you talk about the loss of Jews to Yiddishkeit over the years, the reform movement has had more korbanos. So numerically, the reform is more destructive, but in terms of affecting the minds of religious Jews, Haskalah may have been a bigger poison. Yeah.
If it's really true that the Haskalah of the Gedolim back then were as the Torah to be portrayed,
yeah.
What exactly changed that the Gedolim now are
Well, first of all, I do want to point out that even in Volozhin, and I'm getting ahead of myself, there was a big machlokas, Rav Chaim and the Netziv. Rav Chaim was much younger. Rav Chaim married the Netziv's granddaughter. The Netziv was, in many ways, a much more open to a lot of things. The Netziv was open to Zionism. The Netziv was open to secular culture. The Netziv closed the yeshiva down because of those other issues, but the nesivos open. Rav Chaim was a big kanoi. In fact, the kanois of the Briskers comes from Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim was against. Rav Chaim was against secular studies. Rav Chaim was against Zionism. Rav Chaim was against all things. So when you say Gedolim, I mean the Netziv had a particular shita, but the Netziv was a bit more broader in perspective than other Gedolim at the time. So just as always the case, there was a machlokas. But in terms of why the Torah world has become more narrow, the problem basically is, it's not for us to be machria who's right and who's wrong. These are shitas of Gedolim. But the issue becomes, the idea is that as the world becomes more corrupt, more degraded, more anti-ruchnius, there sometimes has to be a desire to close out more of those influences. The influences become more destructive. As they become more destructive, there tends to be a circling of the wagons. I mean, I'll give you an example. Another example of this, I'm sure you've heard of this. I hate for this to be an avenue for all sorts of lashon hara or gossip, but it's good that you hear this. I'm sure you've heard of the making of a gadol. You've heard that the whole story. That Rav Nachum Kamenetsky wrote a big biography of his father, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. And it was a great, great biography, fascinating biography. Now, this is already later than our Tikkufa. This is already in the early 20th century. But he explores the whole world of the yeshivas, the pressures of Haskalah, the idea that so many B'nai Torah either left Yiddishkeit or they were involved in secularism. And he even writes that Rav Yaakov was very interested in history, and Rav Aaron Cutler liked Dostoevsky or Tolstoy, which he would read. You know, things like that. And to give you a picture that things were not like 100% straight and narrow, but there were a lot of different things going on. And as you know, what happened was that the making of a gadol was banned. There were a chush of people in Eretz Israel that said, it's not proper, it's Lashon Hara on Gedolim, you shouldn't talk about Gedolim this way, our B'nai Torah shouldn't be exposed to these ideas, and the book was banned. And because Rav Nassan is a Talmud Chacham and a Yerei Shemayim, he withdrew. He says, if the Gedolim say not to publish it, he withdrew it. He tried to revise it with a Madura Basra to take out some of that stuff, and that didn't make it either. So he withdrew it. You can't get it now, although I'm told on eBay you can get it for $1,000. Now, I really regret it. I could have bought my $25 copy at the time. But now for $1,000, somebody's making money. I don't know how many people are buying it. But this is a good example. Now, you might say, well, what's going on? I mean, did Rav Nachum Kamenetsky lie? I mean, are people saying he's a chakran? I don't think there's anybody in the world that believes that Rav Nachum Kamenetsky said anything false. But there is a hashkafa, which maybe you hear and maybe you don't, that some ideas should not necessarily be shared with the larger public because it may lead people astray. Now, this is a hard question. Do we believe that censorship of true information is an appropriate response if it will create sveikas in hashkafa for people? So apparently, the prevailing Das Torah is that it's kedai not to be mefarsem certain inyanim if it'll confuse people who are raised in a certain framework. I'm not here to be machriya on that. Now, you may ask the question, so why am I talking about this? Well, the reason I'm talking about it is that there is a nafkamina between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz Laretz. And there is a nafkamina, and this nafkamina is important. That Haredi society in Eretz Yisrael, by and large, B'nai Torah, have not been exposed to certain things. So there's a cheshbon to say, don't open up Pandora's boxes. Don't open up questions. Just like when the Rambam wrote the Moreh Nevuchim. And the Rambam tried to prove the existence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu by Aristotelian philosophy. And there were Rishonim that put the Rambam's works in Cheirim. Because the concept is, if one is a maimon, why bring up questions whether there's God? Le'idach Gisa, in Or Sameach, you come and you go to Rabbi Gottlieb's lectures, and you're going to hear proofs of the existence of God. Aren't we not supposed to? The answer is, if you come from an environment where you've heard apikorsis and you've been exposed to these things, then you need to address issues in a way that people who have not been raised in that environment. Right? So what I tell you is this. What I tell you is that there are things that might not be appropriate for B'nai Torah who were raised in a more closed society that you fellows need to hear to some degree, because you've had your share of apikorsis, I assume. I've had my share of apikorsis, so certainly. And we just need to understand the different pressures and influences that existed in the world of Torah. So it's been my shita, my understanding, although maybe it's my pshat and I can't say it's right, that a lot of the charanim and a lot of the bans and a lot of the censorship is really a message for Eretz Yisrael more than it is for Chutz La'aretz people. And Chutz La'aretz people need to be exposed to a greater diversity of ideas, just because we already have all the apikorsa and we need to understand how the Torah deals with his nisanus. Now, you have to know that Haskalah was such a powerful force throughout the 19th century and even the 20th century that there were many, many gedolim that were really caught up in it. Rav Aaron Cutler, who was a Yassim. Rav Aaron Cutler lost his parents at a young age. And the Maskilim in Minsk were looking at him. They were like spying, like catching him. Because here's this brilliant kid. And they wanted to send him to university. And you know, he was poor, he didn't know. And he was like 12, they wanted to send him to college. And his sister, his older sister, was actually a professor of mathematics. And she wanted him to go to university. And it was only Rav Ruvain Grozovsky, who was his older chaver, who got him to Slobodka. So Rav Aaron was, as you know, just an inch away from becoming a professor. Now, somebody said, it's almost funny, that years later, he met Rav Aaron's sister in an old age home. And this is after Rav Aaron was the Gadol Hador, and Rav Aaron had started Lakewood. And the sister was still saying, you know, what a loss to the world of mathematics he would have been. He would have been such a great mathematician. So from her perspective, the whole thing was a shanda, you know. But Rav Aaron, you know, we were as close to... Now, take someone like Albert Einstein, where I think you have the tragedy in the other direction. You know, Einstein grew up in an assimilated German home. Einstein was not so much encounter with Haskalah as it was Reform. I mean, Einstein's family were the second generation of Reform, which already was not practicing Judaism in any way. But somehow, when Einstein was 12, he somehow got interested in Yiddishkeit. And he was in the process of becoming a Baal Tshuva. And what happened was his parents took in a Jewish medical student whose name, of all things, was Max Talmud. A strange name. And the medical student was an atheist. And the medical student like talked Einstein out of it. Now there, you think the other way around. What would have happened if someone like Einstein would have become... Right, so E equals MC squared, someone else would have to discover. All right, but that would have happened anyway. You know, the scientific Welt says that if there wouldn't have been an Einstein, the formula would have been discovered maybe 20 years later. You know, it would have gotten there. Science has its own momentum. It's not like without Einstein there wouldn't have been anything. But imagine what the Torah world lost. You know, so it worked both ways. On one hand, Rav Aaron Cutler was a victory for Torah. And unfortunately, Einstein was a defeat for Torah. But that's what it was. The Maskilim would target the best and the brightest. They would look around for smart, brilliant Jewish children and try to get them. The Chafetz Chaim was also a Yassim. A lot of these Gedolim lost their parents at very, very young ages, and they were orphans. The Chafetz Chaim, as a young man, was targeted by Maskilim in Vilna. They wanted to bring him into secular education, and for whatever reason, he was miskaber. And because of this, the Chafetz Chaim had an unusual hate for the Maskilim. And it's unusual because the Chafetz Chaim had a shita when people would come and ask him to curse. You know, people go to the Chafetz Chaim because the Chafetz Chaim has such a kayach of bracha, so people would always ask the Chafetz Chaim to either curse people or bless people. So people would say, hey, my partner's cheating me in business, can you just give him a curse that'll go bankrupt, whatever it is. And the Chafetz Chaim had a shita, and he said, I don't curse people. Even a guy, an anti-Semite, you know, a Sona Yisrael, people would say, could you curse this guy that he'll die? The Chafetz Chaim says he doesn't curse people. but maskilim he would curse. He would say, Yimashpo is a God. Because he mamish saw them as mesis umeidich. And part of why the feeling was so deep is because he knows himself, he knew in his own life that he was close to going chutz l'machane. So the Haskalah was very, very tenacious in looking for brilliant, orphaned Jewish kids, and they would offer them money, and they would offer them parnasa, and they would offer them all sorts of scholarships to kind of go to the colleges. We have Yisrael Salantra's children. A number of his children were not from. They were captured by the Haskalah. In fact, one of his children became a famous mathematician. Rav Yisrael Salantra's family name was Lipkin, Rav Yisrael Lipkin. So there is something in mathematics called the Lipkin parallelogram. Whatever, it's a certain shape, geometric shape and formula. That's Rav Yisrael Salantra's son. Now, I want to tell you this. The Maskilim, again, I'm going ahead of myself because this is already the end of the 19th century. The Maskilim, when Professor Lipkin won an award for his science, so the Maskilim put in an ad. They're saying, Dr. Lipkin is the son of the great rabbi, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who, of course, must be very, very proud of the great achievements of his son in the area of mathematics this was published in the Yiddish paper, that bring Kiddush Hashem to the world and restore the glory of the Jewish people. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter put in an ad in the paper next week saying that I love my son dearly, but it is a source of tremendous pain that my son is not a Shomer Mitzvos. I am not proud in what he's doing. It's a shame and a busha and an avla. And if anybody could be Makarev, my son, I would be eternally in his debt. So he had to put in such an end. Because the Maskilim were trying to say that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter endorsed Haskalah. They were using all these different things. Okay, we'll see you next time.
I would say the thanks to the style of the German. That's why.